This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Now today,
I think most architects are taught through the plan, through form, and colours seen as being sort of a dangerous territory.
Why are architects, in the West at least, afraid of a splash of colour? And how can we get more into our built environment? That's just one of the questions posed at this year's London Festival of Architecture, and we shed some light on the answers. All that, plus plenty more besides, coming up right here on Monocle on Design. Do stay tuned. Now, our cities are in a constant state of flux, a tension between the urge to build, rebuild and renovate. And the UK capital is both profoundly united, it's liberal, connected, multicultural and economically successful, but also woefully divided. Many people are being priced out, there are too few houses and a growing and unappealing whiff of insularity. What even is a Londoner when 4 in 10 of the capital's residents are born abroad? And who is the city built for? And how can it improve the life of the people that live here? Is London that age-old seat of a long-gone empire? Is it the crucible of Wren's Portland stone palaces or of Foster's forceful glass and steel upstarts? Identity then, what it means to be a person in a place, and that sense of continuity between the past, present and future are quite tricky notions to nail down. Identity is also the theme of this year's London Festival of Architecture, which wraps up this week. Now in its 11th edition, the festival hosts some 500 events, from walking tours to feisty discussions across the city and across the month of June. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Tamsy Thompson, the festival's director.
This is my third festival. But because I arrived very close to the first festival, this is really the second one that I've been really involved in the programming of. So it's really exciting for me.
No, it is very exciting. And I was looking at the website. I mean, there are about 500 events. Do you have to go out every evening? Tell us about the quantity and what are those events?
Yeah, so we actually recounted them just before I came here, and there are exactly 500 events now, because would you believe it, they still come in. So it is an incredibly busy schedule. Obviously, some days tend to be busier than others, more events at the weekend and towards the end of the week. But for me and the team, we're out every night and often in the morning as well, going all over London, seeing all sorts of things, from discussions on how to curate art events to kids' Lego workshops and everything in between.
How did the festival change since you started working there?
I think for me, I come from an architectural background and I'd worked previously at the Royal Institute of British Architects. So had spent the last 11 years working in architecture in London specifically. So was very aware of the challenges, but also the opportunities that we have here in specifically in this city. And I think what we really want to do with this festival is make it a festival that's about London. So compared to perhaps some of the other architecture and design biennales and festivals that are out there, this one is very specifically about the city that it's based in and very much for a London audience. So we have a sort of core of professionals who come to some very professional facing or academic events. But then we also have a lot of kind of family friendly, pop in, casual, public focused events like our great architectural bake-off or our Lego challenge and some of the installations that we have in around the city. So very much reaching out beyond that core audience as well.
And the main theme for this year's festival is also identity, with something so current as well, especially for 2018. Tell us a bit more about that.
Basically, we picked the festival theme at the end of the previous festival. So we were having conversations about this theme in July of last year. And if you sort of think back to where we were as a city at that moment, identity really quickly came out as the obvious theme. And for us, there's the Brexit conversation, which we can't shy away from and has a particular impact on our profession, partly because of the diversity in the workforce. Over a quarter of architects in London come from European countries, so that's an immediate impact. But also a lot of the work, the procurement and our place in London as the kind of world leader is affected by that. So aside from Brexit, July, obviously, we were dealing with the aftermath of the terrible incident in Grenfell, which for us, obviously, aside and as well as all the horrific consequences of that, it sort of brought very much to the forefront the role of the architect and who procures our buildings, how those buildings are produced, what they're made of, who they're for, where they are, and the identity of London, and lots of the conversation that has come post Grenfell, but also around some of the wider issues of estate regeneration and how we treat the social housing within our city, is very much about what our city looks like, who lives in our city, where they live in the city, and the approach that we collectively as a city want to take to those issues. So it was an overlaying of that kind of wider political with a very sort of London focused conversation, and this role of the architect conversation that we felt really we could pull out with a theme like identity.
You mentioned that this is a very London focused festival as well, but is it international? I mean, London is an international city, so all the major international firms are here in the city. So I guess they were invited also to participate.
Absolutely. And I was saying to someone earlier, actually, we sort of are international by virtue of London being international. So we very much consider ourselves international, but for a London audience, if that makes sense. So we do have people who come here from all over the world to experience the festival and take part. But that's more to do with the, you know, enormous number of nationalities who live and work, particularly in architecture, but more broadly within the city. And also, as you said, the number of people who come here to either procure their architecture or to work in the architecture firms, all the major firms who have a London office. Also within the schools of architecture, there's a huge international contingent within the student body.
When it comes to architecture, do you think London is a very challenging city in terms of being an inclusive city to other people? Because there's been a lot of, you know, criticism. Some neighbourhoods in London, for example, you know, some people, they just don't live there. They're just massive properties where they're just empty. Do you think there's a lot of issues going on, especially state housing, regeneration as well?
Yeah, I think London is really struggling with its identity at the moment. And I've lived in London for pretty much my entire life. And the problems facing London in the 80s and the early 90s were almost the opposite of the issues facing us now. So at that point, there was a massive drive to get people into the city centres, to create this kind of cafe lifestyle, to get people wanting to take part in a kind of urban lifestyle. Now that's been hugely successful and people want to, but a consequence of that and other factors has driven up property prices, and that has led to its own challenges, which I think we're only now as a society catching up with the consequences of what that actually means when people who are key service providers and then more so are unable to live in the city centre. And what does that actually mean for us?
And for our listeners are, you know, they're listening, say, where should I go for the festival? Where can they find more information?
So we have a website, thelondonfestivalofarchitecture.org, and everything is listed there, all 500 events, and you're able to search it. Follow us on Twitter, where we're constantly talking about some of the events that are coming up.
Tell us about your typical day.
The programme is very packed. We have morning seminars, discussions and breakfasts, events. And then throughout the day, we have a lot of exhibitions and installations that are open, and then an extraordinarily large amount of evening events, which range from kind of networking, receptions and parties to talks, lectures, debates and symposium, alongside kind of smaller scale events that are happening within individual architects' practices. And then across the weekend, we tend to have the more kind of family friendly facing events. So our great architectural bake-off, where architectural practices compete to make and bake cakes in the shape of buildings, which is a highly competitive afternoon. So if you want to see ruthless...
Can we taste it after?
You can. Though I have to say, most of them have got so much sugar in them to hold them up and create these elaborate structures.
Okay.
They don't actually taste that great. But they are absolutely fantastic. And if you do look at our Twitter or our website, you'll see some of the images from last year and the lengths that people go to. So we've had everything from the Shard to the Millennium Dome in sugar.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco there, speaking to the director of the London Festival of Architecture, Tamsy Thompson. The festival runs to the end of this week. At their best, public-facing events such as the London Festival of Architecture prompt debate, probe boundaries and pose questions. One talk that caught the Monocle on Design team's eye and captured our imagination was entitled Conversations on Colour, a roundtable discussion hosted by the British firm Hawkins Brown. Are architects in the West afraid of using colour? Could and should colour theory make a comeback to the curriculum? Or are we being too black and white about the whole thing? These were just some of the questions posed. Keen to lend a little colour to proceedings, Monocle's Daphne Karnesis went along to the event to find out just a little more.
I'm Morag Morrison and I'm partner in charge of interiors at Hawkins Brown. I have a strong personal interest in colour and also was sort of working with artists, so that's my background.
I'm Helena Howard and I'm an architect at Hawkins Brown.
Within Hawkins Brown, we have a history and a reputation for using colour quite strongly in our buildings, both internally and externally. And I used to get called the colour police years ago because people used to come to me about how to use colour and what colour would work in the schemes. Especially using colour at big scale can be quite intimidating. Anyway, the opportunity came up within Hawkins Brown as part of the think tank to do a research project. And both Helena and me are very interested in colour. And we were saying, well, can we research into this and find ways of being more successful or more confident probably with using colour, and you know, how do contemporary practitioners do it successfully? And there's a sort of fear that colour is something very transient, it can go in and out of fashion, it's slightly cheap, whereas this kind of Western modernist tradition is about truth to materials and form follows function, and that colour is seen as a bit naff or a bit of an afterthought.
You know, when you work with developers, they'll very often say it's really important that we keep the flats white because then they'll be easier to sell. And there's this fear that if you engage with one specific colour over another, that that will turn some people off it and some people will like it, but white is kind of universal. And I think that's quite unusual and a bit strange because the world that we surround ourselves by is completely colourful, you know, nature, advertising, you know, fruit and vegetables, everything.
I'm Fiona McLaughlin, I'm Professor of Architectural Practice at Edinburgh University. I think most architects are taught through the plan, through form, and colour is seen as being sort of a dangerous territory. And I think also perhaps because there are some poor examples out there. And I suppose my interest in colour is trying to develop a more knowing use of colour. So not just using colour for colour's sake, but using it well. And that's really where I'm interested in educating architects to actually use colour better. At the moment, yes, I did have a research project, and the Architectural Association in London has a small project in first year, 3 weeks with the artist Anthony Malinowski. So he's been running that for some time. Oxford Brookes had somebody, Byron Michaladis, who retired, and now Edinburgh has its own colour course, yes, which we just started in September last year. So we start with a 3 week sort of workshops where they are doing some colour theory. They're thinking about what words, you know, like what is the colour of ambiguity, for instance. They have to paint it for me, or they paint what is male, or they paint what is female. And it's really, we can then discuss these things that sometimes are quite loaded. And then we do look at complementary colours. A lot of the emphasis is on trying to get them back to painting, because architects very often come in with those skills, but then they're not using them. So, and then the students go off and investigate their own interests. So whether it's to do with colour and light, or sometimes to do with computer use of colour, but mainly I try and bring them always back to, well, what does this mean for architecture? So we had a really lovely study on colour and weathering, so how buildings become very green over time. I'm absolutely not in favour of colour for colour's sake. It's got to be done well. I don't just want everyone to stick colour on buildings. I think we've got to be subtle when subtlety is required, and confidence and daring when daring is required. I suppose people feel then that it might date or something of that kind, which I don't think's a problem. I mean, I think we enjoy the colours of the 50s and we identify buildings of the 50s because of that palette. Perhaps there's also a sense that certain colours might be appropriate and some colours not appropriate in terms of architecture, which is not true for the artists.
My name is David Batchelor and I'm an artist and writer. There are a few colours I don't use. I mean, the one colour I definitely don't use is brown, and partly because you can't really do a bright brown, and partly because an awful lot of British art is that's its favourite palette. And so I think that, yeah, there's enough of it around already. And, you know, I'm always drawn to the more vivid colours, beige and magnolia, these passive-aggressive colours I avoid like the plague. One of the things I do is occasionally do commissions for buildings, public buildings or sometimes private buildings. I've done railway stations and hospitals. The commissions tend to be large-scale sculptural works of one kind or another, which involve, in my case, a lot of colour. And that often works simply because the architectural environment is itself very neutral. The grey of concrete or the soft yellow of London brick or steel and glass and so forth. My work, in a way, it becomes a very vivid counterpoint to this more neutral backdrop. A project that's still running, I think, on the roof of the Hayward Gallery, which was refurbished over the last couple of years, and they have a series of pyramid lights on the roof, which have an LED system incorporated in them now, and I programmed that to work as a kind of chromatic clock. So the both roofs of the Hayward Gallery are always a single colour, and gradually over the period of an hour, they will go through the visible spectrum from red through orange, yellow, green, blue, purple, and back to red. So that if you know that it's red on the hour, you'll know that it's green at about 25 minutes past, say. So that's what one recent project. If you look at Western philosophy and Western art history and Western criticism and some Western art, yeah, there is a strong resistance to colour, particularly in the old teaching systems. You don't find that resistance in other cultures, it seems. And colour is often represented in these sort of chromophobic traditions as being somehow other to the Western mind, as being oriental or primitive or feminine very often, or infantile or kitsch.
I think what we discovered in our research is that for colour to work successfully, it has to be thought of very early on in the design process, at concept stage, and it's built into that process really from the start. So people like Piers Goff, he actually builds it into the planning process, and it's part of the planning submission that there is a colour strategy report ingrained into the sort of early design. Basic kind of colour theory and understanding how colours work and they contrast or complement each other is something that should be taught, and it was taught, you know, it was intrinsic to the Bauhaus teaching, and then that sort of disappeared. And I think if people have that basic kind of toolkit or understanding, it will give them confidence.
Our thanks to Daphne Karnesis for seizing that golden opportunity and bringing us the interviews from the London Festival of Architecture, which ends this week.
Summer is finally here, and so is Monocle's bumper July-August double issue. This is when we zero in on quality of life and cities, why we love them, what makes them actually work, and how they need to improve. As always, we reveal our ranking of the top 25 cities to live in worldwide. Find out if your city makes the cut. And for the first time, we present our manifesto for creating a more relaxed city. A guide to breathing in and lightening up. And a celebration of everything from taking your kit off to making a bit of a racket. In the affairs pages, we meet the urban heroes giving back to their hometowns. While in design, we take a closer look at greenery in the city and how to do it right. Elsewhere, we take a dip in Geneva's top swimming spot, we tuck into some northern Spanish grub, and we sit down for a mass with the locals in a few Bavarian beer gardens. Prost! That's all in the July-August issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
Now, at a time when living spaces are shrinking, is the bathroom becoming more important as a space within the home? It is, after all, one of the few places where people can still regroup and make a little time for themselves. That's very much the hope of the folks at Duravit, a Black Forest-based firm that has been manufacturing sumptuous sinks and tasteful taps since 1817. You may well recognise its distinctive, if abstract, logo of a wood grouse, which has been synonymous with the brand since its introduction in the 1930s. Last week, however, Duravit, that German mainstay, opened its first showroom in London. Flush with ideas for an interview, Monocle's Daphne Karnesis spoke to the company's Ghana-born Swiss designer, Kurt Merkey Jr., about the future of the bathroom.
Jr. is because my dad is also called Kurt Merkey. I don't like to say I'm a designer, I like to say I'm a guy that creates stuff. So I deal from interior to product design. I've also done illustration. I'm in Zurich, Switzerland. I'm born in Ghana. My dad is Swiss and my mom is from Ghana. I'm the second son. My DNA code is... I'm joking.
You can tell me if you like.
But I've no idea. I would say is that the bathroom is a very special place because I would say 100 years ago in German, you called it the Nasszelle. That means the wet space, like the wet room. So it was an unimportant room just to freshen up and come back out. Nobody really wanted to stay in there. So there has been obviously a difference, a transformation. But I think that the future of the bathroom in the near time is a connected bathroom with technology, but also with aesthetics, also with the layout of the house that one lives in, or say the space that one lives in. And I think that connection that the kitchen has done with the living room slowly will happen with the bathroom. The people that produce the products for the bathroom are not really in control of that. It's the architects, is the people that create the rooms. And they have to understand there's an opportunity there, you know. I think the initial sense of a bathroom will stay, but connected to improve certain things, to make things easier, that I can walk into my bathroom and I say, fill the bath. It knows my weight, it knows how tall I am, so it knows how much water to put in there, you know. My new furniture I've designed for Dura, the X Square, is going to be there. I've not seen it in this large-scale design. I was not able to go to the Salone del Mobile this year, so I'm super excited to see the showroom and see how the layout is done and the installation and stuff. So I'm quite excited to see it. The new line I've created has to do with simplicity and reducing. So reducing materials, reducing style. I'm not very interested in style. I'm interested in a zeitgeist, in a way of doing things. So it's a furniture series for the bathroom. It's composed of classic furniture design and with a metal profile that sits in the corner of the furniture, and it transforms itself into a stand. It protects the corner because it's out of metal, it's chromed, so it fits to every type of surfaces, whether wood or color. So it has this reduced element to it and purity to it. So when you see it, I hope you have the feeling, I've seen this before, and at the same time be like, wow, this is new. My level of creativity is, first, I design something. My wife looks at it. If it passes my wife, bingo. Then it has to go to Durat. If it passes Duravit, bingo.
That was Kurt Merkey Jr., a designer for the bathroom design firm Duravit, speaking to Monocle's Daphne Karnizes. Next up, we pull a bit of a U-turn to discuss the future of mobility, and specifically the tantalising changes at play in the transportation industry. Although most talk frequently turns from self-driving cars to the potential of supersonic travel, there's one idea we spotted bobbing on the horizon that we wanted to investigate a little further: the buoyant future of the self-driving ship. Monocle's senior correspondent Sophie Grove sent us this report.
We've all heard about the potential and perils of self-driving cars, but less is said about autonomous ships. The tankers and container vessels that transport our goods across continents and hemispheres are evolving. Pioneered by companies such as Rolls-Royce Marine, technology will soon allow commercial ships to operate without a crew. Before the decade is out, they estimate tankers laden with goods could traverse the seas without human intervention. The age-old maritime industry could soon see radical changes to its working model and to the design of its ships. Autonomous vessels don't need a ruddy-faced captain at the helm, but instead rely on sensors and GPS technology to steer them across the high seas. Algorithms and satellite communication will chart their course, and self-diagnosing maintenance will spot things like engine failure. The ships of the future will look and perform differently. Because there'll be no crew present, there's no need for a bridge, no cabins, no berth, no galley, no captain's mess. Rolls-Royce Marine argue, this is much safer. Aboard an autonomous ship, there is no one to take hostage in the event of a pirate attack. If anyone does clamber aboard, they have no shelter, and the vessel can be stopped or sent automatically to rendezvous with the authorities. The ships of the future will be sleek, pared down, and more environmentally friendly. Diesel-guzzling supertankers will use fuels such as liquefied natural gas and even solar energy, with panels placed along the ship. And yet, like self-driving cars, no one really knows whether these smart ships will truly be safer. Even the International Maritime Organization have said they can't be sure, though they credit technology with slashing the amount of boats lost at sea from 300 to 100 per year in the past 30 years, despite the rise in sea traffic. This month, industry figures will muster in Amsterdam to swap notes on the future of autonomous vessels. Meanwhile, the International Maritime Organization has launched a scoping study to work out how many companies are trialing ships. It wants to determine how the conventions that govern international waters should adapt to the onset of crewless shipping. Many cannot fathom the idea of autonomous ships usurping traditional vessels. And it's true, the very idea of a crewless cruise is simply alarming. Even so, there is certainly change in the offing, and the nautical industry must ready itself for a new era where robots rule the waves. For Monocle, I'm Sophie Grove.
That was Monocle's senior correspondent, Sophie Grove, dropping anchor in the murky waters of this self-driving ship debate. A version of this story first appeared in Monocle's Spring Weekly newspaper. And don't forget, you can keep your eyes peeled this August for the Summer Weekly. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. However, next week...
What you're trying to do is to organise a lot of stuff. You're trying to organise streets and block structures and parks and open spaces and transportation systems.
Do cities need central business districts? And can you commission one from scratch? We head to China to speak to the urban planner behind what's set to be one of the world's largest. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening. Ta-ta.